Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Heavy representation from the dismal science of today's show. In moments, the economist and former advisor to the Labour Party, James Meadway, will put his party's loss in last month's election in a larger historical and geographical context and offer some ideas on how to reindustrialize the deindustrialized regions that have provided support for reactionary politicians. And then Catherine Moose will put some numbers on the costs of social reproduction and who pays for them. I guess we're supposed to regard an election that happened a bit over a month ago as old news and move on, but I'm bored with our own election and looking for a distraction. That, plus there are some real lessons to be learned from the British experience. Like, are we right when we say that the problems of our Democratic Party and social democratic parties abroad can be cured by reversing their neoliberal turn? And what do we do about the regions around the world that have seen their factory and mining jobs disappear and have turned to the right for answers? Certainly, the auto plants are not coming back, not that motor vehicles are the wave of the future, nor are the mining jobs coming back, not that they were always so great either. So what to do instead? Here's James Meadway with some things to think about. Meadway was an economic advisor to the Shadow Chancellor, so he saw the Jeremy Corbyn transformation of the Labour Party up close. He's a fellow at the Institute for Public Policy Research, which describes itself as Britain's preeminent progressive think tank, and is working on a book about how to design an economy for all. James Meadway. We've been through many postmortems on the election results, but has anything new occurred to you in the last week or two?
What, in terms of what went wrong?
Yes,
not particularly. The only one that leaps out is that I think we need to be wary of leaping for pretty superficial explanations that either it was all Jeremy Corbyn's fault or it was all the Brexit position fault. I think you're looking at here a problem that's been building up for 20 years, really, in Britain, that starts to appear after 1997, where you have large numbers of traditional Labour places that are drifting away from Labour. And what you saw this time round was a bunch of them tipped over into Conservatives, but that is a problem 20 years in the making. And it's a similar issue to what you see across Europe for social democratic parties right way across Europe. So this isn't down to some specific factor in Britain that if only something had been different, this would have been a radically different result. I don't think that applies. So the first one is that there is a big picture problem here. We have to start with that. We could have, frankly, have managed some parts of it better, but it would still have been a real sort of slog to try and get to the sort of results we want, I think.
Well, things seemed so hopeful a couple of years ago, and then it just all dissipated in recent months. What happened?
There's a couple of things. I think that if you take the run-up from 2015, Jeremy Corbyn getting elected, to 2017, the results that given the polling going into the election, given the media onslaught, given all the situation that we'd seen, and the expectations of Labour being utterly wiped out and all that sort of stuff, and then actually massively overperforming, and not just massively overperforming, completely defying the trend to put on, you know, millions of extra votes, the biggest increase in Labour's vote share since 1945. Not quite enough, I should say, to obviously win. And the reason we didn't win is because, if you look at it, and this kind of gets forgotten, is that the Conservative vote actually increased more. So it was Labour's surge that stopped a big thumping Tory majority appearing in 2017. And then if you take the years since, I think we didn't reproduce the sort of conditions that we could have done coming into the 2019 election. I think I've written a relatively long article and some of the what I think were mistakes made in terms of the presentation of policy, the approach to economics that in particular that was taken. I mean, these are policy questions. It's not the be-all and end-all of everything you can do. And that in practice we also had in Boris Johnson a Conservative leadership that managed to learn the lessons of 2017, which is, broadly speaking, that they actually had a pretty good strategy in 2017. It delivered a lot of votes, extra votes for the Conservatives, but it wasn't quite enough. So a much more focus, much more discipline this time. They were very clear about what they wanted to say and who they were targeting. They went for it. They learned the lessons of 2017. We, to a certain extent, didn't learn the same lessons in quite the same way. And this is part of why you get the results that we saw.
You mentioned that this is a common problem for center-left social democratic parties around the world. A lot of us have comforted ourselves with the story that the reason for those problems is that they've stepped away from their historical role, moved towards the center, embraced neoliberalism, turned their back on the working class. That's not what Jeremy Corbyn did. Jeremy Corbyn represented, at least to some degree, a reversal of that turn, and the result was not very happy. So are all the comforting stories we tell ourselves incorrect?
there's a degree to which there's a story we tell ourselves, and there's our ability to tell that story to everyone else, which is, you know, we can tell ourselves that Labour is a different organisation now, and it's true. It's like, if you look at Jeremy Corbyn, he was a clear break with neoliberalism, and that has delivered a significant improvement in Labour's total vote. Even if you take, you know, the loss in votes this time, Labour is still well above what it was in 2015 and 2010 and 2005, if you take the total number of votes we got, particularly amongst the young. There's a whole layer of, and I don't like the kind of generational thing that gets played up here, that, you know, if you're a sort of older, often retired worker in the north of England, then you are working class, whereas if you live in a big city and maybe you're not white, then, and maybe you even went to university, but now you have some terrible insecure job, you're not really working class. It's nonsense. There's a new layer of younger workers who are very, very solid Labour voters now. That is the big strength that Labour has, and that is built up just in the last few years under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. It's just not quite enough to actually deliver yeah, the majority across the whole country that you want to get to. So there was a shift in what Labour does at the top. I don't think that was necessarily turned into the perception of a fundamental shift across the rest of society. And I do think one of the things that we ended up with was Jeremy looking like he was just another politician. I think that's one of the factors that comes in here between 2017 and 2019, is that he ended up being successfully painted not as the insurgent candidate, the candidate who was going to take on the establishment, somebody who was going to stand up for working people in this country, at least for large numbers of people, he wasn't seen like this, but instead he was just another establishment politician. And the Brexit twirling and the they called it ambiguity, at least this is what the press called it, you know, strategic ambiguity on Brexit. What was Jeremy Corbyn's real position? What was Labour's real position? Was it leave? Was it remain? That for 2 years, I think, was really damaging to Jeremy Corbyn personally in terms of what people identified him as. You know, you go in 2017, knock on doors and find Conservative voters who'd say, I don't agree with him, but he's principled. In 2019, that just didn't happen, because he'd lost that sense of being a different kind of politician because of this sort of ambiguity around Brexit. He just looked like he was triangulating. That really sort of damaged us, I think, with a load of people. And at that point, everything else starts to stack up as well in terms of the media onslaught. It really starts to gain the purchase.
It seems that one of the triumphs of neoliberalism has been to convince people that politics just doesn't offer any hope for making their lives better. That it's, you know, all yourself and collective forms of action are antique and laughable. Is that at play?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, I think this is like probably the major thing. If you think about the places that have, like I say, for 20 years, I mean, Britain has a useless electoral system, frankly. Useless, not particularly democratic electoral system. It suffers from similar sets of problems to the US in a slightly different form, in that you can have large numbers of people vote for a party and it gets virtually no representation matching that. And you can have these weird geographical impacts where actually for 20 years, Labour was still winning places on decreasing majorities, winning individual constituencies, and at some point they're going to end up in the Conservative camp. And that's more or less what happened here. The biggest shift in Labour vote between 2017 and 2019 was Labour voters in 2017 going to non-voters rather than Labour voters going to Conservative voters. There was some of that happening, but not very much. But that's a product of a kind of despair of politics in general. That if you have 10 years of austerity, like vicious spending cuts, the worst for generations in this country, on top of 40 years or 30 years on top of neoliberalism, where, you know, these sort of deindustrialized rust belt areas, you might call them in the US setting, they just haven't had any investment, all the good jobs have gone, they're replaced with that best crap jobs that are insecure, that are poorly paid. Go to somewhere like Shirebrook in Bolsover, the, you know, sort of historic mining area. Shirebrook used to have a mine that it supplied. Okay, mining's not, you know, it's a pretty horrible job, but by the end it was quite well paid, secure, you know, good, solid employment. That's all gone, replaced with one of the worst employers in the country, Sports Direct, and the appalling sort of conditions that people were subject to there. Insecure work, working for a warehouse, sending out, you know, bags full of trainers and other sporting goods, that sort of thing. So it's a change, a really fundamental shift in how these places function economically. And all through this, you have not just a Conservative Party that implements neoliberalism, you have a Labour Party that doesn't really address the fundamentals of it. So of course at this point you get despair at politics and the ability to do anything. The sense of agency, the Labour Party is not there looking after you, the trade unions have all disappeared and withered on the vine in large numbers of these places. There's nothing left. So there's a real sense that politicians can't do anything, politics can't do anything, there's nothing we can do. You know, there's this kind of negativity that builds up around absolutely everything. Labour marches into this in 2019 with a manifesto that says, we can do all these things, and it's just greeted with pure cynicism. It just, you know, how can we possibly have this? How can government do anything? It hasn't done for 40 years, fundamentally, so why is it going to start now? That's the cynicism that you're up against.
Is there any way to fight that?
I think so. I think in the policy sense, I do think this is something we got importantly right in 2017, that we failed. I mean, you know, I wasn't particularly involved with the decisions, but that Labour failed to get right in 2019, which is that if you're dealing with cynicism like this, you have to use that cynicism to your advantage. You have to go out and say, okay, the only thing you think government can do is make life worse. So before I can talk about how government might make life better, how things could be better, I'm going to tell you who life is going to be made worse for. You have to name your enemy. You have to say, okay, I mean, this is the populist moment. If you have large numbers of people who have just seen nothing out of the economy for a long period of time, they believe the economy to be fundamentally a zero-sum game. In other words, I can only become better off if you over there become worse off. So you have to say who's going to be worse off first. You don't come out and say everything's going to be great, this is how we're going to pay for it, this is how it's going to work. You have to come out first and tell people, this is what we're going to do. And in 2017, we said, we are going to increase taxes for the top 5% of people. Now, the kind of Blairite wisdom on this is that you should never talk about tax increases, and you should certainly never talk about tax increases for the wealthy, because everyone thinks they're wealth creators and all that sort of stuff. This turns out to be nonsense. Once you name the people and the institutions, so it's top 5%, big corporations, that's who's going to pay. Once you make that clear in people's heads, and you drum that into people's heads, and the press love this because they're very happy to talk about Labour tax increases. Once that's in everybody's head, then you get a bit of a license to talk about how things are going to be nicer, because you've said who's going to pay. You've taken this mentality of a zero-sum game, completely understandable, by the way, if you're in some place that hasn't seen any investment for years, that you get on television news about how the economy is growing, but your wages are lower now than they were 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 years ago, then it's completely understandable that people believe this is a zero-sum game. You go out, you say, this is who's going to pay, now we can talk about how it's going to be better. We didn't do that this time around, and that was quite a clear policy slip. Now, that doesn't address a long-term problem. The long-term problem is a much, much bigger thing of rebuilding institutions, of talking about how do we deliver power, meaningful power, meaningful control over people's lives in some of these places, and that includes, I think, the necessity now of talking about constitutional reform, which sounds incredibly wonky, but you turn it into how do we make our democracy work better? How do you have a BBC, for instance, that actually responds and listens to people, that's fair and democratic? How do we, for instance, deal with the question of Scottish independence, which is now looming large over this year? All of these things are big constitutional questions that we need kind of popular answers that people can grasp and say, yes, this will make a difference to our lives. That, I think, is how you start to rebuild a left in Britain and probably elsewhere.
I'm speaking with James Meadway, former UK Labour Party economic advisor. Now let's shift to the topic of your piece in Tribune, de-industrialization. I notice you have a double negative there. Why not re-industrialization?
Oh, okay. Not my choice of headline, usually way of writing these things. But I think it was probably just to try and get people's attention, I suppose that was it. I mean, the issue with that piece is saying, look, there are moments of hope in all of this, that the version of, I would argue, socialism that we need to get to by this point, and given the way technology works and society is working, is not the sort of centralized, let's have big investment in factories, making stuff. There will be some of that. If you want to make, you know, if you want to seriously do a Green New Deal sort of investment program, then that's going to involve some big construction of things like tidal barrages in Britain, building wind turbines on a very large scale. That's a kind of mass production question. But an awful lot of what you can do now, thanks to digital technology, thanks to improvements in manufacturing, is relatively small-scale production. So you can go to some of these places that used to have manufacturing production, which has disappeared over the last 30, 40 years. It used to be relatively small scale, relatively smaller factories in some of the parts of the north of England, places like where I'm from up in the northwest, used to have these relatively smaller factories. That's all disappeared. You've had this rush to scale in the last sort of 30, 40 years or so. New technology now means you can reverse some of that and say, look, we can have collectively owned production of goods. We can have worker ownership that is viable and economically viable because you have it on a small scale. You can do high technology manufacturing with 3D printing, with these sort of new techniques, additive manufacturing, this sort of thing. And it's actually starting to happen. You can see this in parts of the country where, you know, historically textile production was big. Again, the Northwest and Yorkshire. You can see some of this is already coming back in with sort of digital printing, digital textile manufacture, small scale, high quality production. Now, once you think about that, and you think about some of the possibilities that you can actually give people the control and the command over these technologies on a scale where it starts to turn around where they live, then I think you've got an attractive model for reindustrializing parts of the country that have been deindustrialized.
I have to admit, when I hear things like 3D printing, it sounds a little bit like George Gilder-ish new economy fantasy spinning. What kind of scale are we talking about? How many people can this sort of thing employ?
That's where the question starts coming, because there's already, like, you can see, I mean, I was up in Brooklyn about this time last year, going to a community 3D, community-owned 3D printing facility. And you can do that on a fairly small scale, and that's really a sort of prototyping scale. Now, if you want to expand on this a little bit, one thing that would be interesting to talk about, for instance, is in the Labour programme, there's a whole scheme to supply effective loft insulation to every house in the country. And the reason you do this is because you've got a huge climate change benefit. Is point number one, that if you have properly insulated houses, people don't need to heat them so much, so that's a big impact on your carbon output from heating people's homes, from the use of energy from that. It also means people save on their heating bills, so it's a kind of win-win there. And there's a third thing, which is quite labour-intensive to insulate everybody's loft, so you create loads of jobs. But then if you follow the supply chain along, Britain has an old housing stock, and a lot of it is quite weirdly shaped, so you can't sort of standardise the production of loft insulation. You have to do it on a fairly sort of batch production basis and fairly specialised. Now, that means smaller scale, more specialised, not absolutely tiny here, somebody as a craftsman, but you're talking a relatively smaller production at this point. And you can do it at scale if you have some of the digital, well, not in this case digital printing, but some of the more advanced manufacturing technologies. And that's a scale of 10, 20 for an area, that kind of thing, that kind of level of employment. And you can reproduce this all over the place. That's just one example of the kind of technologies you might start thinking about if you have an industrial strategy geared towards delivering this sort of employment. The other interesting one is what if you start moving towards a circular economy? What if instead of saying, right, your phone's fallen apart, you're just going to throw it away, what if you start saying, well, we're going to build into all of our manufacturing, in fact, everything we do, the idea of getting to a zero waste point. So it's a circular economy. You have something that's now not working, you take it back into a production process, you refit it and put it back out again. That is, again, pretty labour intensive. It's going to involve reprogramming, remanufacturing, you know, recycling, all of these different skills that you can start to build in there. And that you can do on a really big scale. You know, the estimates for a potential in Britain is 500,000 jobs by 2030 if you've got serious about trying to make an industrial strategy operate like this. So this is potentially quite big. It's not just like here's a few guys and girls with in somewhere like, you know, Shoreditch fiddling about on a computer, and it's not really going to affect people. You could potentially roll this out across the whole country and fundamentally change how the economy operates.
And now, of course, it's Brexit is going to be an abrupt reality rather soon. What effect will that have on this kind of industrial planning you're thinking of? Will it make it easier, harder?
This is where things get interesting in a way that I strongly suspect the Conservative government we have is going to move beyond what we might think of as neoliberalism. In other words, it's going to be quite strongly economically interventionist. Boris Johnson, new Prime Minister, has already talked before the election, even during the election campaign, of using state aid, in other words, government spending, government subsidies even, to support manufacturing across the country. Now, this is a big old break with the neoliberal model of, you know, create a level playing field, competition policy is everything, government isn't going to interfere. It's deliberately saying we're going to go out and do that. And that is potentially a breach with EU rules, because the EU has strict rules about you are not allowed to intervene in parts of the economy to try and favour certain industries, certain areas, that sort of thing. I say strict, I mean, it was always possible to find ways around this. Some of them you're allowed to sort of say that, oh, this is an environmental benefit, so you can go and invest over there. And frankly, if you're one of the bigger countries, you just ignore a lot of this stuff anyway. So it was never quite as strictly as enforced as sometimes it's made out. But that's Boris Johnson, Conservative Prime Minister, talking about state intervention, delivering huge amounts of investment, relatively huge, not relative to the scale that's needed, really, but relatively large amounts of investment to the north of England. So already we're getting out of a kind of neoliberal setting. We're into something potentially that's much more interventionist and somewhat different to what we're seeing. That has an interaction with what they might want to argue on Brexit. My guess is, after banging a big drum about wanting no deal, is that they absolutely don't want a no deal, ultimate hard Brexit. We just walk away, because it's just economically, on any scale, it looks really, really difficult. And you as a government just don't want to inflict that on your country. You carry the can for doing this. So they will avoid that. They want to get to a deal. They set a timeline of a year. So in theory, at the end of this year, we have to have an agreement with the EU on how we leave and therefore avoid a no-deal Brexit. It's likely that the government, after making a great deal of fuss in order to sort of play hardball with the EU, will eventually say, OK, well, we'll extend that deadline and still come back to negotiations and see where we get to. One of their senior advisors, a guy called Tim Montgomery, was over in Hungary. He's a big fan of Viktor Orban and the regime over there, talking about how, you know, we're going to have a soft Brexit, in other words, a close relationship with the EU, not changing too much, and that's how the government's going to play it. And I suspect that would be their preference, given that this minimises economic disruption, and in particular, it doesn't sort of affect some of the places where you've just won a whole bunch of MPs and that are a bit more dependent on manufacturing than some other parts of the country, for example. So I think they'll try and get to a soft Brexit, but given the size of the majority they have a great deal of freedom to manoeuvre on that.
Finally, do you believe Johnson's talk about investing in the North? Trump made similar noises during the campaign and then nothing happened. So is Johnson going to be a reprise of that Trump bloviation?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question. I mean, the political systems operate somewhat differently. I suppose Trump, in the end, I think it's my understanding of it anyway, favoured trying to charge at doing the wall and migration rather than trying to push through the sort of investment plan. It just got eaten up in all kinds of Washington shenanigans one way or the other. In this country, we have a government with a solid majority. If they want to do something, broadly speaking, the Constitution is sitting there enabling them to do that. So if they want to deliver at least some investment, they can do that with interest rates still, I mean, almost the lowest in recorded history is the kind of interest rates that governments face, certainly the British government faces at this point in time. There is literally no reason not to just borrow and do some capital spending. What's extraordinary in the last 10 years is that this hasn't happened, despite the historically low interest rates. And given where they have won these new seats and given the MPs they have in the parts of the country have and the kind of promises they've made, there will be direct political pressure on government from their MPs to try and do something. Now, the question there is, having set all these expectations about what's going to happen to parts of the country that haven't seen investment, will they be able to meet them? So that's your obvious first point of attack, because you want to set the expectations high and then, you know, say you failed to actually seriously invest in these places. This is because you're Tories. The other one is that it won't fundamentally change the economy. Like, they're not saying anything about dealing with a gig economy and insecure work. In fact, they're almost certainly going to make that harder because it's going to be harder to provide trade union organisations. They're talking about banning strikes in certain industries and altogether and that sort of thing. So they're not going to address the fundamentals there. So I think there's another route in, if you're on the left, to say, well, actually, this isn't addressing the real problems. Yes, OK, maybe they've managed to open a new railway line. Perhaps they've even built a new road or something. This is not really addressing the big old problems that we face in Britain. We face across, you know, the developed world in general, which is casualisation of labour, decline of trade union organisation, rampant inequality is not something they're going to address anytime soon. Maybe some token bits and pieces, but they're not going to do that. So he might deliver on at least some of the investment, because there's not much holding him back at this point in time, but it's all the other bits of the economy that aren't working that I think he's going to run into problems with.
That was the economist James Meadway, formerly a UK Labour Party economic advisor and now a fellow at the Institute for Public Policy Research, a think tank. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. I was sort of Working Class Hero, the John Lennon song covered by Marianne Faithfull. I always worry that the lyrics are patronizing, though Lennon himself was the son of a merchant seaman. Faithfull's class origins are somewhat posher, father was a British intelligence officer and a professor of Italian, and her mother was the descendant of Austro-Hungarian royalty. All reservations aside, is a great performance of a great song. Next, who pays the cost of social reproduction? Social reproduction theory, the study of what processes keep us alive and healthy enough to work, such as housework, child-rearing, and even community development, all outside the monetary economy, can be traced back to Marx, but it was greatly developed by feminist scholars in the 1970s. It waned along with Marxism in later decades, but has undergone a revival lately, as has socialism. Tithi Bhattacharya was on this show just over a year ago to talk about a collection she edited on the topic. And now here's Catherine Moose to put some numbers on the concept. Moose is an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and the author of an article in the Review of Social Economy. Using data produced by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the BEA, which is the agency that compiles the national income accounts, Moose finds that employers are paying for a declining share of the cost of reproducing labor power. Moose talks about the BEA's household accounts, which attempt to measure the value of what's produced by unpaid housework and such. The estimate is done by counting up the hours devoted to such tasks and multiplying them by the typical wage for domestic labor. BEA's latest estimate is that the value of such production was $4.5 trillion in 2017, an amount equal to almost a quarter of GDP and over half the total of all wages and salaries paid in the U.S. that year. As women have entered the paid labor force in large numbers, they have less time to devote to unpaid labor, so the quantity of household production has declined relative to GDP. But women still do the lion's share of the work. Here's how BEA summarizes the gender division of household labor. Non-employed women spend more hours per week on these categories than employed women. However, employed women spend more hours per week than non-employed men, with employed men spending the fewest hours per week on household work. It's the end of the BEA quote. Men are doing more work than they used to, but we're still slackers when it comes to the housework. Okay, here's Catherine Moose. Let's start by talking about what we mean by social reproduction. The phrase is much in use these days, it seems, but what does it mean?
Social reproduction refers to the processes that are required to nurture and maintain and replenish the labor force, both on a day-to-day basis. So what does it take for all of us to be able to show up for work the next day? We need to go home. We need to eat and sleep and bathe and have social relationships. But it also refers to social reproduction of generations. So having children, caring for the next generation of workers, as well as the current generation and the previous generation. That's typically what we mean when we say social reproduction, particularly if we're talking about social reproduction of our capacity to work, which is also called labor power. But you could also think about the social reproduction even more holistically. You can think of social reproduction of institutional structure, social reproduction of the capitalist or the patriarchal system, so on and so forth.
Yeah, that anticipated my next question, which is, you know, we have several features here, basic biological reproduction of the human creature, the reproduction of the worker as worker, which means not merely just health, but also skills and education, and then also the reproduction of capitalist society as a thing. How do these all fit together? Is this all part of social reproduction?
I would say yes, they're all part of social reproduction. So we certainly will not have a capitalist system without the social reproduction of workers, without the social reproduction of our labor power, our capacity to work. But that's also true of other institutional structures. So without reproducing the wage-labor relationship or without reproducing certain identity-based hierarchies, these are all things that get reproduced. Some of them we might like more than others or think that are favorable to workers. Some are not favorable to workers. That's why social reproduction and social reproduction theory is a really rich field, because we can talk about sort of the nitty-gritty of biological social reproduction. Some people take it more in the sort of ideological or cultural realm. But the way I see it is that these are all really interconnected processes and systems. You can think about it on a micro level or a macro level.
It seemed like there's a lot of interest in this topic back in the 70s when Marxist feminism was really much more of a thing. But it kind of interest waned some, but now we've seen it revive in the last few years. Do you have any thoughts about why that trajectory has come to be?
Yeah, well, I think it's really exciting that there's this resurgence of interest in Marxist feminism and that there's this really rich theory that goes along with it. In the 70s and 80s, in the academic literature, there was something called the domestic labor debate. So it was really all about responding to the claims of Marxist feminists, particularly the Wages for Housework campaign, that were saying reproductive labor, what happens in the home and elsewhere, is productive work and it should be compensated as such, it should be valued as such. And then some more orthodox Marxists, particularly from economic tradition, saying, you know, hold on, we have very specific meaning with what we mean by productive and unproductive, and what you're saying really sort of violates that. And it led to this sort of academic debate. And then it kind of died down for a little while, and now it's sort of re-blossomed as social reproduction theory. And certainly the reason why I think it's interesting is that it answers a lot of questions in a more holistic way. It also poses a lot more questions, but about, you know, what's going on in our society. When it's not just a class-based analysis, it's not just a gender-based analysis, it's really taking the capitalist system and patriarchal system and really looking at them as intertwined and related.
In, you know, the business press, the bourgeois media, often see these articles on work-life balance. That this is, I guess, the mainstream approach to the problem of the world of work and the world of care and reproduction try to work in harmony. They don't work in harmony very easily, but this is, I guess the mainstream is trying to think about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly guilty of talking about work-life balance or breadwinning and caregiving responsibilities as being completely separate when truly they're very much related. But I think the reason why we hear about this even in the bourgeois media, or in 2016 we were hearing Clinton putting forth plans for work-life balance, and then Ivanka Trump, which of course was garbage, but just going to help, you know, rich women like herself, if anyone. But I think what they're responding to is that there really is a problem. In U.S. society is not set up to allow families and individuals and people to balance both their responsibilities to their community, to their family, to themselves, and to their employers. We put these things at odds because I think in our society, we pushed so much of the responsibility of social reproduction onto the individual and onto the individual family. So we haven't socialized things like childcare or healthcare or elder care or all these things that would really make society take some of the burden of social reproduction and of socially reproductive labor out of the individual home. And it's caused a crisis for all kinds of people, certainly people at the bottom of the income distribution, but also people in the middle and at the top. When you see even really high executive women complaining about the inability to balance these things, I think that's where it sort of hit a breaking point where now all of a sudden they care.
You said something there that I wanted to draw out. It's not just about the reproduction of the family or, you know, the individual worker, but also community, something larger than the family, the sort of thing that Margaret Thatcher said didn't exist. It's something that does exist, and a lot of that work of social reproduction outside the home is also not really paid for.
Oh, that's right. I mean, even things like volunteer work or what people are doing to help their neighbors or to care for the children that belong to their friends or their nieces and nephews, or volunteering to help feed people who don't have enough to eat. I mean, these are all things that we're doing to sort of socially reproduce ourselves and each other. And so much of it has been pushed onto workers because of all these failures to provide an adequate and dignified and sustainable life for so many people.
As women have entered the paid labor force, men have been picking up some of the slack in the household, but not entirely. So a disproportionate amount of this work of social reproduction falls on women. We just learned last week that the number of women working in the U.S. surpassed that number of men in December. But still, a lot of the household tasks are still women's work, right?
Right. And so we have seen tiny studies. This is analysis that people do of, in the U.S. context, the American Time Use Study, where people keep time diaries and actually record how they spend their every minute of their day, show that men are doing more unpaid household work than they used to, and women are doing a little bit less, but women still do more than men do. I mean, there's a lot of things that play into that. There's gender norms, there's ideas about femininity and about who's more caring or who's more nurturing, whose responsibility it is to take care of kids or aging parents and so on. So a lot of these are sort of persistent inequities that happen in the home, and they make a big difference to people's lives.
And over the decades, a lot of this kind of work, food particularly, but also child care, elder sick care, cleaning, and such has been commercialized, entered the monetary sector and out of the realm of the purely domestic sector. But that kind of work is also disproportionately done by women, and it suffers a wage penalty because of that, right?
Yeah, that's right. A lot of this work is done by women, and a lot of this work is done by women of color, by immigrants, and there's often very low wages associated with things like childcare, home health care aid, cleaning, you mentioned, all sorts of things. So not only is socially reproductive work often unpaid and compensated not at all, but it's often, if it is in the marketplace, so to speak, it's often received very low wages. So that actually affects how we value it in society and also affects how we consider its worth, economically speaking.
I came across a factoid some years ago that I thought was really striking, but also very revealing. Parking lot attendants are paid more than child care workers. I guess
it's stunning, isn't it? I mean,
cars are more valuable than kids, but also, you know, men are the parking lot attendants and women are the child care workers. It's okay, so now let's get on to the heart of your paper. Who pays for this stuff? You know, we've got several options: the state, people themselves, employers. You have a taxonomy of the class structure of the U.S., a three-part class structure that you take from Simon Mohan. Tell us about, first of all, that three-part class structure.
So this three-part class structure I take from the work of Simon Mohan, who is an economist in the U.K., and he talks about, even as a Marxist economist, he says, you know, we really need to get past looking at this in the very traditional way of there just being capitalists and workers, capitalists who don't work and workers who do work for pay, and that actually in contemporary U.S. society, there's actually really at least a three-part structure. There are what he calls working capitalists, or people who have enough wealth that they don't have to work for wages, but they often do work for wages and get very, very high income. Then there are managers who don't have enough independent wealth to forego working for wages, but they exercise a supervisory role in their job. So for that reason, they're also different than the working class because they exercise command and control in the workplace. Then there are workers. So workers are people who must work for wages, and this is where we get sort of to a traditional Marxian view of what a worker is. They must work for wages in order to be able to survive, and they don't exercise command and control in the workplace. So they're really defined by their subordination within the system.
What rough percentages of society are we talking about for each of these three groups?
So the managerial class represents about, on average, around 15% of total tax units, but they're gaining around 30% or more than 30% of the total income. And the managerial class has actually grown over time, which I found somewhat interesting. It's grown since the 1980s. So there's been some tracking with the rise of neoliberalism and the growth of tax units that fit into this managerial class. The capitalist class represents around 1%, and they're earning up to 10 or even 23% of the income. And the working class, of course, is the majority, anywhere from 80 to 90% of the population, but only getting between 40 to 60% of total income.
Do you have any thoughts on why that managerial class has grown in recent years?
Yeah, it's a good question. I didn't look very deeply into it for the purpose of this paper, but I did think about it a little bit. There's been an explosion of top incomes, right? So we know that for the top 1%, they are gaining more and more relative to the rest of the population. And I think it's also true of other high income earners who aren't necessarily the very, very top, but more business and managerial workers are sort of being classified as managers and then gaining these really high income. It's a deeper sociological question about sort of what's happening in the structuring of the workplace, but I believe it there's a sort of new layers of upper management that are being put in at the expense really of the working class.
Yeah, well, you certainly see that in university, right? The administrators are just like proliferating like a fungus. I'm speaking with the economist Catherine Moose. Okay, so now to do your estimates of who's paying this stuff, what did you define in economic terms as the costs of social reproduction? What components are they?
Yeah, so I thought about the cost of social reproduction as consisting of really all of the wages and benefits that we receive as workers from our employers. So that includes our wages and our salaries and our employer-based benefits, so healthcare, pensions, so on and so forth. And then I subtracted the taxes that we pay as workers, because when you pay taxes, you don't have that money to pay for your own social reproduction. It may come back to you in the form of government spending. I do add in all of the government programs that are for the reproduction of the working class, so things like Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, education, so on and so forth. I also include an estimate of nonprofit expenditures. I include an imputed value of household production. So this is unpaid household work, cleaning, cooking, childcare, so on, and that has a imputed value on it. And then I also include consumer borrowing, because the assumption is that if you're borrowing, you're using it for your social reproduction. So this is a very sort of basic framework to just say, these are the main components that go into our social reproduction, and I'm assuming that we're spending all of our wages on our own social reproduction. So that's one assumption that I'm making. I don't tease out, this is essential social reproductive expense, and this is a luxury expense. I'm saying if you're paying for something, then it is for your own social reproduction.
So that Netflix subscription would count.
Sure. I mean, other social reproduction theorists would agree with me on this, that, rest and leisure and enjoyment are all parts of social reproduction. I mean, certainly if you think about going home after a very exhausting day and not having any energy for anything but to binge watch your favorite show, if that makes you feel more rested and replenished the next day when you show up to work with a clear mind because you spent however long zoning out in front of the TV, then I would say yes, that was part of your social reproduction.
You also include an imputed estimate of household production, which we can talk about the complexities of how to estimate that, but let's just bracket that because this is radio. What can we say about the value of that domestic production? What does it consist of, and how does it compare to market production?
What I use is what's called a satellite account. So the Bureau of Economic Analysis has created this satellite account, which estimates the value of household production. And they do that by taking all of the hours in various activities that I mentioned before, cooking, cleaning, childcare, and so forth, and then they multiply it by a general wage of a domestic worker. So this is what's called a generalist approach. There are a couple ways of doing it. And this gives them a monetary value of all of the work that is actually unpaid. And so what they're able to do with this is they're able to say, well, GDP would actually be much larger if we included this unpaid household reproduction. The size of the economy, when you think about expanding it in terms of unpaid work, is actually much larger. But then I use this data, which they were generous enough to share with me, to estimate, okay, well, how would I put this into my equation? I need some kind of monetary equivalent, but it is an imputed value.
And how big is it compared to market production?
When one of the interesting findings of this paper that actually really surprised me is that when I looked at household production as a component of social reproduction, both for all households, so this is working capitalist managers and workers all together, and also just for working class households, I do them separately, we see that over time, the importance of household production really stays pretty large. So household production, even though people are benefiting from household labor saving technologies like dishwashers and washing machines, they're still doing a lot of housework, and that comes up in the data. And we see, particularly when we look at for workers, that as workers' incomes have stagnated, the role of household production actually has become even more important over time. So in the case of the working class, what I found is that household production was actually always a greater contributor to workers' social reproduction than net wages and benefits, which actually kind of surprised me.
Yeah, we thought that the capitalism had replaced the household as a center of economic activity, but clearly it hasn't. It hasn't. It's just marginalized it from being noticed.
Exactly. I mean, and one thing, and other researchers have found this, that while we do have access to washing machines and dishwashers, other things have changed. You know, now it's not considered appropriate in most places to leave young children unattended, and there's all sorts of intensive parenting that are sort of required. So people are spending a lot more time with their kid. They might not be washing their laundry by hand anymore, or even doing their dishes by hand, but they're spending more time doing other things, and that shows up in the data.
Okay, so let's return to the three groupings of society here. How do the patterns differ among the three in who pays for the cost of social reproduction?
What was very interesting is when I break this out into all households, supervisory households. So there I take capitalists and managers and link them together, because I'm arguing that in this context, managers are more similar to capitalists than they are to workers. And so for supervisors, net wages and benefits is larger contributor to social reproduction and actually grows because their incomes have just exploded since the 1980s and are just rising and rising. Now that doesn't mean that household production is not important. It's still happening, but net wages and benefits are very, very important. For workers, as I said before, household production is from 1959 to 2012, which is the time period I study, household production is the greatest contributor to social reproduction until the crisis. And the crisis, actually, government benefits become the greatest component of working class social reproduction, because after 2008, there was additional unemployment benefits and food stamps and so on and so forth, and you see that in the data reflecting. So, but before then, household production was the greatest contributor to working class social reproduction, and wages and benefits was always below that. And actually, in the mid 90s, wages and benefits and government benefits start to get much closer, and it isn't actually until the early 2000s that government benefits increased. So that's another finding that is kind of counterintuitive, knowing what we know about neoliberalism and its assault on the working class. But I think what we're getting at are sort of uncovering two things. One is that the first part is that it's not true that breadwinners are the major contributor to household social reproduction, and the caregivers are just sort of filling in the gaps or doing this non-essential things. Actually, it's people's caregiving responsibilities that are contributing a huge amount to household social reproduction. So that's the first thing. This really, to me, validated arguments that feminists have been making for decades and really kind of showed it in the data for the working class. The second part about government intervention to social reproduction is that I think even on the left, there's this idea that in the U.S., the welfare state is completely underdeveloped and very stingy, and that is true relative to other countries. But what's not true is that it's not playing any role in social reproduction. It actually continues to play a role, even despite the rhetoric of people need to lift themselves up by their bootstraps and go it alone. And actually what I've found in this paper and in other research is that in neoliberalism, the neoliberal era, because wages and benefits have stagnated so much, that actually the role of government benefits has increased relative to the role of the employer. So I'm arguing that employers are playing a decreasing role in the reproduction of the working class, and that leaves households and government left to sort of fill in those gaps and take on the lion's share of it.
So the moral here is that the capitalists have been very, very successful at shifting the cost of social reproduction to other people.
Exactly.
Yeah, nice work. Yeah. You can get it, right?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that they very successfully pushed the responsibility of social reproduction off their own backs and onto the household where it always was, and that's sort of part of the ideology. But then the lie of it all is that the government is also having to play a role, and it's sort of a myth that that the government is not involved.
That is striking how little this enters our political discourse. You know, not something that they talk about in presidential debates very much.
It's true. I think part of it is that the problem, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, is discussed in very different terms. So it's about how do we get work-life balance? How can families manage this? And it's not saying, you know, hey, employers aren't doing their fair share. They're not being held responsible. If we're going to have a wage labor system, which we can, you know, debate the merits of, but if we're going to have one, then employers need to pay their fair share. They need to make it possible for their workers to reproduce themselves and reproduce their families. And you do that through good wages and good benefits.
That was Catherine Moose, an assistant professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and the author of a newly published article in the Review of Social Economy on the cost of social reproduction. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some of Bust and Loose by Nona Hendricks and Material. Till next week, bye.